Good morning, everybody. This is
Dithering on the Edge of Europe. The podcast about what it feels like to live in the UK and on the edge of Europe, the climate catastrophe, the pandemics, you name it. I can't even express the word pandemics.
Pandemics, yes. Pandemics? Only one pandemic, I hope. I'm Rich McCarthy. I'm an ex-teacher, an ex-energy auditor, and a present dad and house husband.
Present? You're not absent dad.
I'm not an absent dad. I'm not an absent house husband. And that's what I'm doing right now I'm doing the podcast, but generally that's what I do.
And I'm Carola Boehm, European, German, wife, mother, academic, and living here in the UK.
Oh, I'm a wounded badger person as well. We just walk along public footpaths to check that there aren't people out doing what they shouldn't be doing.
But of course, we're not going to talk about badgers. We're continuing our talk about the Green Deal of the European Union, which we started last week. We were covering clean energy and biodiversity, big subjects, big topics. And today we will tackle three big topics: sustainable agriculture, sustainable industry, and eliminating pollution. And they are all in the Green Deal of the European Union. The European Union has expressed that it will become the world's first climate neutral bloc by 2050. So shall we jump into sustainable agriculture?
Yeah, they won't get the attention they deserve from us, I fear, but we'll have to give it a go.
Yeah, and do you remember where we initially said, oh, we're going to have one episode per Green Deal?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then it took us two episodes for the Green Party's Green Deal. It took us three episodes for the Labour Party.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to go four, maybe, for the
EU Green Deal.
And when we get to the Conservative government, it'll take us 10 minutes.
Well, we'll just say there is no Green New Deal from the Conservative government. So, boom.
Right. Okay. So, sustainable agriculture in terms of the Green Deal of the European Union. The European Union's policies are, of course, long-standing. They have been around, like the Common Agricultural Policy, like some other policies as well. So, other things feed into this policy, which is in the Green Deal. They have finally put some attention to the Common Agricultural Policy, because, of course, it had a lot of critique.
Yeah.
And rightly so. It was made for a different kind of era. It was for the post-war era.
Yeah.
And
for the 60s, basically.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
And the three pillars, if you want to say it like that, are social sustainability, economic sustainability, and environmental sustainability.
Okay.
And I've got a quote here just to start us off. Farmers, agri-food businesses, foresters, and rural communities have an essential role to play in several of the Green Deal's key policies, including, and of course, now they're mentioning strategies and policies that appear also in other places. You know, there's building a sustainable food system through farm-to-fork strategy. Now, the farm-to-fork strategy we dealt with in the last episode, of course, adding to the biodiversity strategy, contribute to climate action, supporting the forestry strategy, and contributing to zero pollution action plan. So all of those things should be supported by this sustainable agriculture element of the Green Deal. And of course, the social aspect is that it's also about food security. And as we just mentioned, you know, the Common Agricultural Policy is one of the, you know, first very, very large policy areas of collaboration in Europe. Was, you know, it had food security as an early objective in this post-war period. It's a good example of where food security is a big thing, and now the green element, the sustainability element, comes in. So transforming production methods and land management systems to reduce pesticides and fertilizers. Now, of course, we talked about that last time as well. And making just best use of nature-based and technological and digital solutions. And of course, you know, when I was reading into it, it's suggested that it also should provide a range of support actions to strengthen farm income and boost competitiveness. And, you know, this notion of competitiveness, you know, we will see that that goes throughout also the Green Deal. And I have a feeling that, you know, maybe we should be beyond focusing or emphasizing competitiveness. That's still a sort of neoliberal mindset that we have to be competitive to be able to survive. Whereas I guess from a sort of different kind of trajectory or thinking, you know, I would actually say, no, we have to be working together to survive rather than to be competitive. But, you know, I have a feeling it's still hung up on that highly marketized mindset from the neoliberal era.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Ursula von der Leyen is still a conservative, isn't she? But one thing it does is it makes those sort of people think, oh, yeah, well, this is all kosher then. This is good. We want to be competitive. It feels like you can be, if you are good at doing something, then you can be benevolent to the rest of the world afterwards. Whereas if you're bad at doing something, if you're not very competitive, then you're just going down, down, down.
Mm.
So we want to be able to show that we're the best. And if we can show that we're the best at doing something, then other people say, oh, that's a good idea. We ought to do that. Whereas if we're, you know, if people start saying, well, you don't want to go to Europe, it's a rubbish place, then it doesn't matter whether, if you succeed in what you want to do climate-wise, that doesn't do any good if they're saying, well, we don't want to be like you because you're rubbish.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, even the recent news in terms of trading agreements, you know, feeds into this discussion that you want to be competitive as a bloc in order to negotiate the best trade agreements.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course, that's why we lament the fact that we're now, you know,
we're not in that bloc.
Mm. And in some ways, you know, the European Union will be, you know, is already, of course, a large bloc, you know, one of our large blocs.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to put Europe almost as you know, not the product, but as the thing that you buy into. And if you have common policies that ensure that when you buy a product from Europe, you know that there are certain quality standards that come with it.
Yeah, you know what you're getting. And that's why the European Union has been so successful over the last 10 to 20 years, because of these standards that they've set and people have stuck to.
Exactly. You know, and I do the same thing. You know, I was promoting a different kind of conference, virtual conference software, to a colleague of mine. And one of the things that I suggested to him said, and actually, the company is based in Britain, so it conforms to GDPR regulations, you know, which are, of course, European regulations. Now, we've now fallen out of, but, you know, these companies have still been adhering to it because they know there's a quality, it's a quality kite mark as such. And I heard a really interesting podcast actually just recently, which was very hopeful because it was a sort of business podcast. And the person was saying that future large businesses will have to deal with ethics much more than our current ones. So in the future, the ethical aspects of your business, your values, will be a key success factor.
Yeah, one would hope so.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I assume that's also driven by a younger generation, you know, the generation which is now growing up with climate catastrophe, who will in time say, you know, look, your older generations, you've basically, you know, messed everything up.
Well, I think if we rely on the younger generation to do it themselves and do it bit by bit and say, oh, we're not going to buy this product or something like that, we're lost.
Mm.
It has to be done by governments, because
absolutely, yeah,
we've been relying on the younger generation for the last two generations. It hasn't done us any good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the younger generation don't have power, and then they become the older generation, and they've only gained power by starting to do exactly the same things that the older generation did. And then they become the older generation, and they start saying, well, I have to do this because I've got kids now and I don't want to lose my job, and somebody up there is telling me I have to do this, so I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just I'll put another pound or dollar or euro into the begging bowl of the next person I see on the street. But that, you know, that's not doing the job, is it?
Yeah. And as part of that whole process, what the European Union is also putting into policy is how to fund information and promotion measures to educate consumers about the EU agriculture and also engage with farmers and, you know, relevant stakeholders in rural areas, so that there is a whole sort of communication strategy in relation to that. And that might mean that the European Commission co-finances projects to inform the public, you know, TV features, farm visits, information campaigns, audiovisual and media activities, apps for smartphones, and of course how they do it. And I'm just going to show you a little image here. So this is a sort of image of a kickoff meeting of the European platform for European journalists, access to food and farming media in EU and beyond. You know, so that they are asking.
Sorry, I'm laughing because the photo looks like the guy is addressing the trees and the plants. You know, it's like, this is the kickoff meeting. There's him, a microphone, trees and plants, and that's it.
Salads. He's recording salads. Okay. I don't know what he's recording, actually.
So, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like much of a meeting, but who knows?
But, you know, the thing that I wanted to mention there is that they, you know, their calls, that's how, of course, they work. They ask for people to apply for projects that deal with communication strategies in their region.
Mm.
And so there is a sort of centrally organized but distributed network of food and farming journalists and professional communicators that is part funded by this tranche, this sort of pillar of this policy.
Okay. That seems like an important thing, because every time I think of farmers, they seem to be people who have really no time because they're always out doing stuff. And they're lonely because there aren't many people working the fields, and they have to stay lonely because they're trying to pay off the costs of their big tractors and big equipment because they've chopped down all the hedgerows and they've got an enormous fields now. And it all seems to be in a, you know, we've gone down some kind of horribly vicious spirally circle to the point that we're at the moment, and we need to slowly come out of it by giving farmers a bit more time to be more communicative, to have more farmers around, more people in the countryside, working on the countryside.
Yeah, and raise awareness of sustainable
machinery.
You know, because I think in some ways consumers haven't been informed about the importance of, you know, locality or origin of their food. You know, that hasn't been put in the picture.
Well, again, the consumers are in the same boat. Everybody's working. Everybody is in a factory right now. It's like, if you're in education, you're in an education factory. If you're in farming, you're in a food factory.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is a factory. And so all these people are working in the factory until they're very tired. Then they get home. They don't want to watch news, or they don't want to hear about what's going on in this industry or that industry. They just want to be entertained a bit and then fall asleep tired to get up the next day.
Yeah. And I think that's what this initiative is about. And I hadn't heard about this initiative before. I think it is a first initiative where you want to ask journalists to come forward to specialize in food and farming. Because, you know, if you think about it, you know, I do remember, you know, having lived in the States for some time, there used to be sort of public awareness campaigns about the health benefits of milk, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And it went on TV left, right and center. And then, you know, those things disappeared. And if you think about it, I haven't seen a single sort of information campaign about eating locally, you know?
Yeah.
A national one. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Yes, there are pressure groups. You know, maybe it's, again, governments just leaving it all to pressure groups. But, you know, there's no...
Well, the government doesn't care. Our government doesn't think about stuff like that, unfortunately.
Yeah. The EU thinks about that. So that's that tranche. And of course, another tranche is about fostering resilient rural communities. So this is about more rurally targeted development and policy. So which then, you know, of course, addresses social inclusion and job creation and diversification. And I just want to mention there, for instance, they have a leader network, which is a European network for rural development. And just for us to understand, so how does that work? How does the European Commission affords nation states to foster resilient rural communities? Well, you've got different kinds of funds. I know, so for instance, the EADF, European Regional Development Fund, I know that fund because one of the projects that I'm leading on as part of my university sort of role is EADF funded, European Regional Development Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, in the future that will fall away. We still have funding for a couple of years, but that is specifically there to look at which areas need a bit of leveling up so they can get that amount of funding. And if there's a consortium there that can pitch towards, you know, how to use that to do the leveling up, that's what it's there for. Then there's the European Social Fund, ESF. You know, many universities are also involved in that. And also the European Maritime and Fisheries Fund. And so you can see those are part of their community-led local development. So they dish out money to the regions and consortiums can pitch for it to actually do the work.
So local places can boost things in their area.
Yeah.
If they're in an area which is not doing well. Normally, basically.
And of course, you know, it's quite nice to see, you know, I was kind of like, yeah, I know what ERDF is about, you know, just to see it here and understand that as part of the Green Deal, they will shift that ERDF calls towards more sustainable ways of using that funds in order to shift the behavior in the regions. You know,
that's good.
It's very effective. And then in terms of farming, of course, you know, and I think we all sort of know that the age group of farmers is quite high. And I've got some statistics here of 8 classes of farm managers. 11% are under 40. So here's a graph.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And so, you know, it's really extreme. So only 0.45% are below 25 years. Maybe that's not surprising because people are still in school, colleges, and universities. But, you know, you would think that...
Not if you want to become a farmer, you're not.
Really. And then only 5% are between 25 and 34.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's...
So 5.5% below the age of 34 then.
Yeah.
Or below the age of 35. Which is your best physical years, really. Obviously, you learn more and you get more skillful and probably you're a better farmer at 40 than you are. I'm sure you're a better farmer at 40 than you are at 25, but physically, you're not.
So this is Eurostat from 2016, you know, of course, the whole European Union. But it is quite shocking that the largest chunk of farmers are above 65 years.
That's all.
Yeah. And of course, you know, that then feeds into food security as well. But this is where they have developed specific policies, so income support, a young farmer's payment, and then also rural development funds, so grants or loans, and loans might be managed locally, but the policy
really
is,
good.
You know, is on the policies at a European level.
Because you'd like to be able to think that young farmers can try it out, you know, so if they have support, then they can do it for a couple of years. They can say, oh, I'm going to try and be a farmer for a couple of years and see how it goes, instead of having to take out millions of loans and this, that, and the other,
and
then be up to your neck in debt and be a failed farmer. You can try and be a farmer and then say, okay, I've had a couple of years, it's not really working out for me, I'll try and do something else instead, without this great big shackle around your neck.
Yeah, and I think the difficulty is that, you know, where the funding might come from, that's a bit more complicated because there are different kinds of funds that have a cross-section that could apply to young farmers. And that's maybe where, you know, Britain sometimes says, or the British government says, oh, it's too complex, you know, because you could say, yes, I want to have a young farmer's payment. Or you could say, well, I'm going to develop this area in this rurality and I'm going to get a grant from this European Investment Bank focused call. Or you could say, I'm going to go to my local bank and under this kind of campaign, I can get a loan for my log, you know, so there are loads of different kinds of means. And that might be, and I don't know, you know, it comes back to communication and publication, you know, this notion of that they need to have consolidated, targeted campaign to allow then the young adults to understand what opportunities there are for them to get onto a successful career within farming. And then another pillar that they, of course, mention is the role of knowledge and innovation. There are things that we still need to understand and how to do better. So just some of the examples, you know, there was a project, there were some pilot projects from 2017 to 2019. One was about smart villages, which are, you know, eco-social villages.
Yep, smart villages.
Smart villages.
Okay.
And I might have...
Smart, so smart eco-social villages, so they have... with loads of digital stuff built in.
They might have digital. We're going to go into digital agriculture, what that actually means. But yes, that project, for instance, was about mapping the opportunities of what a smart village could be, but also understanding the definition of a smart village. You know, so they also looked at, okay, so where does the digital technology, you know, where does the
but, smart village, nobody's allowed to chew bits of grass in their mouth because that makes you look a bit stupid. So no, that's not a smart village.
It also looks at best practices, and then also, okay, so if we understand what the best practice is, how do you become smart? Now I only think about this grass chewing person when I talk about smart villages.
The thing that reminds me of is the John Cleese film Clockwork, where he's a head teacher trying to get to some big thing, and he's driven his car into a field, and there's a farmer on the other side of a fence talking to him, and he's trying to get out of the field, and the farmer is sitting on a tractor waiting for him to say something like, "Oh gosh, I need some help." And he doesn't say that. He's all bolshy and stuff, and the guy's chewing a bit of grass. Yes. And he's like, "Well, good luck with that then." And only comes along to save him later on. So.
Yes. Well, let's look at a bit of not a smart village, but smart farm. Mm-hmm. Because when I came across that word, you know, digital agriculture, you know, what does that actually mean? And of course, the European Union has a handy infographics.
Yeah.
Which is quite cute, with loads of little farmers.
Yeah.
And
two farmers in the picture, two farmers
who
both look the same.
There's a woman.
And a woman.
With a butterfly net.
Is a butterfly catcher, yes.
Yes.
But she's thinking about hating sheep because she's got a sheep crossed out next to her.
Yeah, right. Okay, so we go to the second icon and you see, suddenly something happened to the farm here because we see a tablet with loads of statistics and one sheep depicted in there.
Held by the male farmer because it's... He's got a green sleeve, like the farmer's top. The female lady, who we're not sure is a farmer, is wearing a blue top, by the way.
Yeah, there's a drone flying across the farm taking pictures. Yeah, I'm not so sure if I would like that. But the cow has a temperature device built in.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you were saying that maybe it's the drone taking pictures of the cows to work out if they're only overheating or underheating.
I don't know. You know, there's also the sheep, which has a GPS tracker.
Yeah. Well, it's gambling around the countryside. Maybe I bet that is done at the moment, but presumably not on every sheep. Maybe they put it on the biggest sheep or the toughest sheep, because where that sheep goes, the other ones are going to follow or be with it. So that you can say, start out the day and go, where are the sheep today? Oh, there they are. And
it's a cute image, but you know, gosh, to me it just sounds horrifying, you know. And if you rely on all that and then the internet goes down, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is supposing that there is an internet. You know, we in Britain, once again, we have crummy internet in lots of country areas. So all this thing about 5G, 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 well, let's get 3G first. For the whole population before we worry about 5G.
But also, did you notice that in the picture, which is, I guess, the before stage, you know, today farmers and foresters face many challenges and strive to make their work more efficient and efficient, you know, but they're all outside, right? Yeah. And then the digital, you know, the farmer is in that house doing email, having a computer in front of him, and all the animals are outside with trackers and stuff like that.
Wondering, you know, what's going on. Like, I'm making loads of milk, but nothing's happening. And the previous picture, the woman is sweating as well. I think, is she sweating?
Yes, she is.
She's sweating because she's in the sun. And so that obviously is a bad thing. But
right.
Apparently, we're all just going to sit in houses and the farm will take care of itself with a smart...
Ach, I don't know. Did you realize that the corn cobs on the before picture, they had brown mold on them?
And now they don't.
Now
right.
They don't.
Oh, what a success.
Simply because they have a water GPS, water sensor on them.
Okay, yeah.
Anyway, so that's digital agriculture. And of course, you know, we don't quite know what that means in real life. How does that feel? You know, what do farms now?
Is that because you haven't done enough
research?
Research. That's why we don't know. It does seem a bit sort of fanciful, and it's like, and this digital stuff will help everything. It's like, yeah, people have been saying that about all sorts of things since the beginning of time.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I studied both, you know, technology and music, art, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm
yeah, you'd be out there playing music to the cows and getting them to produce more milk, wouldn't you? So,
but, you know, I do think we rely a bit too much on that vision that the digital will get us out of a lot of our dilemma. And I think that is probably...
Whereas
not
actually
quite.
It's clear thinking and being fair. Being fair is such an enormous thing that motivates people left, right and centre.
Yeah. And we've seen that in the vision of Ursula von der Leyen as well, that there's a big sort of digital revolution. You're becoming a big digital player and stuff like that. And of course, you know, yes, we do need digital there, but, you know, let's, you know, it's going to be one of the elements which is part of our life. You know, we don't need to emphasize it. You know, I just think that the word almost has lost all really significance because, you know, we do stuff now with technology, but we've always done, you know, humans have always done stuff with technology, but haven't emphasized.
And now it's the idea, it's like magic. Oh, I've got a digital, you know, I've got a digital car. I've got a magic car. It can fly. It can produce any type of food I want out of the glove compartment. It can do all these things because it's magic. And now we're using the word digital instead.
Well, I was trying to find an analogy. You know, it's probably not a good analogy. But when fire was invented, did they call themselves the Fire Society? But having said that,
they
probably did. And of course, when metals came around, you know, we have the Bronze Age. Yeah. You know, so I assume it's probably fair to say that we're going to call this the digital age, just like the Bronze Age. You know, retrospectively, we called it the Bronze Age.
Yeah.
Back to the role of knowledge and innovation. So we have, of course, different kinds of tools to afford, you know, again, nation states to understand the role of knowledge and innovation in pushing forward these policies. And again, you know, there's, of course, right at the top, the Horizon 2020 framework, which is a research and innovation framework, which I, as an academic, know, of course, very well. And of course, from my experience in the Horizon 2020, as an evaluator, as well as a researcher, you know, I know that it has shifted very much towards sustainability, circular economy. So all of those applications, if you apply to the European Union under the Horizon 2020, you have to meet those criteria, which are part of
the Green
Deal. You
have to be thinking them and building them into your bid and
exactly.
Saying how you're going to benefit the world in those respects.
So that's the Horizon 2020. But then there's, of course, the European Agricultural Fund for Rural Development. And we've heard about that a bit earlier on already. There's also the LIFE program. And I didn't know the LIFE program, which is an environment and climate action program since 1992.
Wow.
And, you know, again...
Because you've been living in this country, probably.
Possibly, you know. And of course, you know, again, the European Commission is quite big and it has loads of programs. And sometimes the overarching program, like the LIFE program, you know, it doesn't appear very often, but the calls underneath, you know, suddenly have their own names and then you suddenly realize what that is.
Right.
But it is a sort of program specifically around environment and climate action has been running in the last period. You know, the last period is 2014 to 2020 and it had a budget of 3.4 billion euros.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, again, you know, there was a sort of, wow, I know what this is. ESPEN. I didn't know. ESPEN. What is ESPEN? And then it was spelled out.
So why did it seem like you did know what it was?
Because spelled out was European Week of Regions and Cities, which is a coming together of regional, you know, sort of actors who research or implement strategies on the basis of regions and cities. And of course, for my work in terms of art and culture, creative cities, you know, that's where I knew that there were a lot of things happening in this European Week of Regions and Cities. And I've used quite a lot of, you know, documents and papers that came from those initiatives. And again, this you know, this has been going on since 2013.
And we know that it's working because people do feel attached to their regions and their cities. As we, you know, ages ago, we looked at This is one of the many things that they look at when they're doing a survey of the whole European Union, and everybody felt attached to their local local. You know,
exactly.
I think it was the attachment rate was something like 70-80% for most of Europe to their locality.
Yeah, but you know, fair to say, we also discussed that in the past, the European Union has probably not attended to the cities and regions as much as it should. It rather looked at more common policies and not as much focused on regions and cities. But it's in the last decade, it's increasingly has done that. And, mm-hmm. you know, this is one of the programs which, you know, which is a good example. And just to talk a bit about numbers, you know, the last year's event attracted 10,000 participants. So there is a lot of spread of information, sharing of good practice. And I think that's also what the European Union is so good at, which I just feel we're losing out on so much. You know, this knowledge that comes from understanding diverse needs in different cities and then being able to understand, okay, so what could work for you by understanding these diverse types of implementing different types of policies and what works and what doesn't.
Mm.
So anyway, there's also, of course, a joint research center, which is part of, you know, the Commission Science and Knowledge Service,
mm-hmm.
which undertakes research in the area of agriculture and food security. So there is a centrally funded center that focuses on probably also collating the research in order to make it then
from
available.
From all the different countries, yeah.
And they make it available through a central farm advisory system. And that farm advisory system is a central hub where, you know, farms or governments can go to and say, you know, we have, for instance, at the moment, a real issue with mice and pesticides. Is there some new developments that we can attend to remedy that? You know, so that's about latest developments and the communication to farming. And of course, that ties into what we mentioned just before, that there's a whole strand about communication and promotion.
Right.
So that's the social aspect, but that was the biggest part. So we leave it at that. And if you enjoyed the show, tell someone about it. Let us know. You know, use Twitter. Or leave a review. That's also a possibility. And we're on...
Bad one if necessary.
no bad ones. And on Twitter, you can find us at DitheringE or just look for Dithering on the Edge of Europe. So you can Ecosia us, mm-hmm. you can DuckDuckGo us, and we would recommend to not Google us, whereas you could find us there as well.
Yes.
Goodbye for now.
And have a fabulous and low-emitting week.
Yes. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye.